to go. Okay, so I'm Matt Johnson. I'm supposed to teach you Introduction to Cosmology. It's probably going to be a little bit more random than that. I think this is just, I get three lectures to teach you things that I think are important, and some of them have to do with cosmology, and some of them have to do with gravity. So I hope that this is kind of a useful set of facts and skills for you. So before I dive into it, I guess just a few words about myself. So I am a faculty here, and I'm also a faculty at York University, which is in Toronto. And my research area is cosmology. So it's appropriate, I guess, that I teach you the intro to cosmology. I'm also interested in quantum gravity, gravity, strong gravity. Things with a G in it are pretty good, G and C. And yeah, so I have a pretty wide set of research interests. And I've taught for Psi, I think this will be my fifth year teaching in some aspect for Psi. So anyway, I really enjoy it. I really enjoy interacting with you guys. So I love questions. Please stop me as often as you want. If you don't feel like stopping me here in this room, come knock on my door. I'm on the second floor. I always forget my office number. So we're in the old building. Okay, so without further ado, Introduction to Cosmology. Okay, so brief outline. I guess I kind of want to do two things. So thing number one that I want to do is what I'll call order of magnitude cosmology. That is no fancy math. Just let's get our hands dirty and talk about scales, units, time scales, length scales, you know, all these things, these nice things that if you really get it in your mind, if you can memorize a few numbers and a few concepts, then pretty much you can do most cosmology. And then you fill in the gaps and you be more precise with the courses that you'll take. So that's not my job to teach you all of cosmology, it's to give you a feeling for what it's like. So that's thing number one. That'll probably take today and maybe a little bit of Thursday. And then thing number two I'd like to talk about is general relativity. So I was told that David explained a little bit about tensors. And so general relativity is where they become really useful. So we'll talk about things like the space-time metric and Einstein's equations. And more or less, the goal here is to have you understand qualitatively what the metric is and what Einstein's equations are and what they're useful for. And of course, one of the major uses for this is cosmology. So we will talk about some solutions to general relativity that are relevant for cosmology. So that's the plan. So let's get started. Okay, so we'll get started with units and scales. And there will be a lot of physics in here, so I hope it's not boring. Okay, so who can tell me what a meter is? Okay, excellent answer. Anyone else venture, I guess? Like, where did it come from? Okay, excellent. Another answer. Any other answers? Okay, my answer is it's a bar in Paris, and not the kind you drink in, but actual physical bar. So somewhere in Paris, there is, I've seen it in a museum, there is a bar. And that's what we call a meter, and we could define it in different ways. It could be like just, you know, distance light travels in a certain amount of time, a certain fraction of the diameter of the Earth. But anyway, you cut it. A meter is basically a unit that is invented for human scale stuff. So a meter, a second, gram, these are all units that we invented because they characterize things that we're familiar with in our everyday experience. But more or less, they're completely arbitrary, right? If we were giants, we wouldn't have defined the meter. We would have defined some other unit, the arg, which is like 10 meters long. So it's really just this arbitrary thing that we invent for convenience. Okay, and the first thing that we learn is that meter is very inconvenient. Cosmology, quantum mechanics, particle physics, etc. And there's some meat to that statement. I mean, that's physical, right? Because the stuff of cosmology and the stuff of particle physics is so radically different than the scales of our everyday experience. And that's why it's so inconvenient. So if we were going to write, you know, the size of the observable universe in meters, what is it? 5 times 6, 9, 12, 15, 18, 21. Okay, that's how many meters the size of the observable universe is. And I think I counted the zeros right, but if I didn't, excuse me, it's just very difficult. Okay, and of course we don't have to write out the zeros, that's just for drama, because scientific notation is a beautiful thing that lets me not write out all the zeros, but the universe is about 5 times 10 to the 26 meters wide. Okay, so probably we do not want to use meters to describe things of cosmology. Okay, so what's a better unit? So let's think of some astronomical scales. Okay, you might recall from Astronomy 101, or for those of you who are astronomy enthusiasts, what a parsec is. So if I think of the Earth orbiting the Sun, here's the Earth in December. Here's the Earth in June. If there is some distant object, then this object will, of course, appear to be at a different angle on the sky depending on what month it is. And that angle, if we measure the difference in angle from December to June and divide it by 2, is called parallax. And so the parsec is a distance, so 1 parsec is equal to the distance of an object subtending 1 arc second of parallax. Okay, so parsec is convenient because it also happens to be the distance to the closest stars, sort of roughly speaking. Parsec also happens to be sort of roughly equal to a light year. It's not a third, it's 3 light years. So this is a nice unit. This unit has to do with astronomical scales. Okay. So this, in fact, the parsec is a unit of choice in cosmology. That's a canonical unit. And so there's a set of distances, more or less, to remember that tell us about the scale of different things in the universe. So we just talked about one. So distance between stars, that's like 1 parsec. Distance across a galaxy, that's like 10 kiloparsecs, so 10,000 parsecs. There's the distance between galaxies. That's sort of like a megaparsec, a million parsecs, roughly speaking. There is, distance. Sorry, not distance between, but size of. So the size of superclusters, that's big groups of galaxies. These are the largest bound structures in the universe, and they're like 10 to 100 megaparsecs. And then finally, there's like the whole shebang. There's the size of the observable universe. And the observable universe is like 10 gigaparsecs. So 10 billion. And these are orders of magnitude, you know, so the real size of the observable universe is not 10, but maybe more like 15. And the, you know, distances across galaxies depend on the galaxy we're talking about. Some are bigger than others. But sort of roughly speaking, in orders of magnitude, this is a good set of distance scales to remember in cosmology. And so once we have a distance scales, we can start doing cosmology with twiddles and estimate a whole bunch of things that we might be interested in. So I don't know, why don't we estimate how many stars in a galaxy? Okay, so we have to make some assumptions. I love these Fermi problems, these order of magnitude problems. I've got some great websites with lots of Fermi problems if you want to have some fun. It's kind of fun. I don't know. Maybe I'm kind of nerdy. My friends and I, when we have parties, we solve Fermi problems. We can assume that a galaxy is a sphere, right? And let's say that the galaxy is sort of uniformly filled with stars. Okay, so that the number then would be a density times a volume. Okay, so a number density of stars times the volume of the galaxy. And we know this information from our order of magnitude estimates. So what's the number density of stars? It's like 1 over a parsec cubed. So if I assume they uniformly fill the sphere, they're separated by roughly a parsec. And the volume, well, that's going to be the distance across a galaxy cubed. So that's going to be 10 times 10 to the 3, which is 10 to the 4 cubed. Okay, so the number is something like 10 to the 12. If we did this a little bit more carefully, sorry, you probably can't see that. So if we did this a little bit more carefully, a number of more like 10 to the 11 would be a bit more accurate. Okay, but pretty close with twiddles, okay, 10 to the 12. Incidentally, if you ever forget that number, you can just remember Carl Sagan, whose favorite phrase was billions and billions. And so so there's like 100 billion stars in a galaxy, and we'll find there's like 100 billion galaxies in the universe, so everything ends up being 100 billion. Okay. So maybe we could estimate some other things, like how many galaxies in a supercluster, for example. Okay, again, we'll make the same assumption that a supercluster is like a sphere, and we can just get the number by a density times a volume. So density times a volume. And the packing density of galaxies, so we said the typical separation between galaxies is like a megaparsec, so that's 1 over megaparsec cubed. And the volume is going to be somewhere between 10 and 100 megaparsecs cubed. Okay, so I don't know, we'll make a big one, 100 megaparsecs cubed. Okay, so that's 10 to the 6. So there's something like, about a million. It's about a million galaxies in a supercluster of galaxies. So just for comparison, our Milky Way galaxy is now known to be part of a super cluster called Lanikea, and that's a recent result. We didn't know that until last year. So in the Lanikea supercluster, there's about 100,000 galaxies. So our TWDLs, this is maybe on the larger side of superclusters, but it's pretty close. You know, there's like million-ish galaxies, 100,000 million-ish. Okay, and then, okay, well now, like, we can get really big. So how many superclusters are there in the whole universe, in the part that we can see anyways, in the observable universe? Okay, so again, number is density times volume, and we can just assume that these superclusters are like packed. So, you know, the density is gonna be, one, say, 1 over 100 megaparsec cubed times the volume, and the volume is 10 gigaparsecs, so that's 10 to the 4 megaparsecs roughly cubed. Okay, so we get 10 to the minus 6 times 10 to the 12, so again, it's like a million. Okay, so there's like a million superclusters in the observable universe. Okay, and now we can get, I don't know, we can keep going. We could probably do this all day, just estimate numbers of things. But maybe let's do one more because it's gonna get us to somewhere interesting. So let's estimate how many stars. So how many stars are there in the entire observable universe? Okay, well, we know that there are roughly a million superclusters, and every supercluster has roughly a million galaxies, and every galaxy has our estimate of 10 to the 12 stars. Okay, so we get about 10 to the 24 stars in the entire observable universe. A better number, more realistic number perhaps, would be something more like 10 to the 22, because I promised you everything was 100 billion from the billions and billions, so there would be 100 billion galaxies, and each galaxy has 100 billion stars, so that's a little bit better estimate, more accurate estimate. We're pretty close with our TWDLs, so 10 to the 24 stars in the observable universe. Okay, so even from here, we could note some like really super interesting things. So first of all, we now know that most of these stars have planets around them. So if we want to compute like the odds of intelligent life or something, that's probably pretty damn good because there's, you know, 10 to the 24 plus planets in the universe. That's a really big number. So even if the chances of life are pretty small, that's a lot of planets. Let's look at this number. Number of superclusters in the universe. So looking at clusters of galaxies is a very useful tool in cosmology. And if I want to compute things, so this is something you might cover later on, but just know it is. So if I want to compute the accuracy of a measurement, usually it goes like 1/√ of the number of things that I can measure. And so there's a finite number of things that I can measure in the universe. So that means there's an intrinsic uncertainty on any of the properties I can measure about the universe. And that's pretty big, right? √1,000,000 is 10 to the 3. So like 1/1,000. So if I want to use superclusters to measure properties of the observable universe, I will be intrinsically limited. And there will be, you know, sort of a smallest error bar that even in principle I can get. And that's something called cosmic variance. And you'll also probably learn a little bit more about that. Okay, so that's all from my TWDLs. There's a lot of interesting things you can learn from these numbers. Okay, so now let's learn something else interesting about the universe. So let's talk about masses and density now. Okay, masses. So again, the gram and the kilogram are probably not going to cut it. We should think of some quantity that is more astronomical in nature. Okay, so in cosmology, we use solar masses. Okay, that's denoted by M circle with a dot in it. I don't know why that ended up being solar mass, but that's the way it is. And that's about 10 to the 27 kilograms. So again, it'd be very inconvenient to express this in terms of kilograms. I get tired of writing the zeros, or I could just remember that I can use scientific notation, but whatever. We'd like a unit that's like one. Okay, so now we can make progress with our twiddles. So we can start estimating the mass of different objects, right? Because we know how many stars there are in different objects. So we can assume, you know, again, sort of in the spirit of Fermi problems, assume all stars are like the sun. And then we could know, for example, the mass of a galaxy should be something like 10 to the 12 solar masses. And that's on the upper end of sizes of galaxies, but it's consistent. Galaxies, yeah, question. 2 times 10 to the 30? Probably is. I probably just looked it up wrong. Yeah. Okay. Google later. You can find it. In grams or kilograms? In kilograms. I probably looked at it and thought it said grams. Okay. All right. Okay, so yeah, galaxy. So there's 10 to the 12 stars. And so we could guess if all those stars are like our sun, then a galaxy should weigh something like 10 to the 12 solar masses. A reasonable range for galaxies is something between, like, I don't know, 10 to the 8 or 10 to the 9, we'll say 10 to the 8, and 10 to the 12 solar masses. So sort of typical galaxies. Okay, so that's a reasonable guess with twiddles. You know, we could compute the mass of a supercluster. Okay, so that's going to be roughly a million galaxies, so something like 10 to the 18 solar masses. And these are the biggest objects in the universe, so the biggest gravitationally bound objects have a mass roughly 10 to the 18, 10 to the 19 solar masses. And if we want to get really big, of course, we could compute the total mass of stars in the observable universe. Okay, and then here we're going to get something like 10 to the 22 solar masses, because there's something like 10 to the 22 stars. I guess I cheated a little bit and I used the more accurate estimate here, but, you know, 10 to the 22, 10 to the 24, something like that. We'll keep it kosher and use 10 to the 24, because I don't want to cheat. Okay, so that's sort of roughly the mass in the observable universe. And now we can do the interesting thing, which is talk about densities. Okay, so as a warm-up, let's compute the average density of stuff of stars in the universe. Okay, so that's going to be roughly the mass in the observable universe over the size of the observable universe cubed. Okay, so we just computed the mass. It's something like 10 to the 24 solar masses. And the size is something like 10 gigaparsecs cubed. Okay, so this is gonna maybe not be the most convenient unit. Maybe we should turn it into like solar masses per parsec, because that's like the average distance per star or between stars. So let's turn that 10 gigaparsecs into 10 to the 10 parsecs. So here we've got 10 to the minus 30, 10 to the 24. So this is something like 10 to the minus 6 solar masses per parsec. So from this we learned something. Even though in a galaxy the average distance between stars is something like a parsec, if I actually averaged over the whole universe, only 1 in a million parsec-sized volumes have a star in it. Per parsec cubed, sorry. So the universe is actually pretty diffuse when you think about it. It's far, far less diffuse than in a galaxy. A galaxy is like a million times more dense than the average. And that's more or less about right. Okay, so so from this we can actually do something else that's of interest. So let's change units back to normal normal everyday person units. So we can multiply this by, I guess the right answer is 10 to 30 kilograms per solar mass. And then we can divide it by 10 to the power 16 meters per parsec cubed. And now my number is not going to come out as impressive as it does before because of the 27 and not the 30. But anyway, we'll get close enough. So we can do this. So this is what, 10 to the minus 6 times 10 to the 30 divided by 10 to the 48. And this is now going to be in kilograms per cubic meter. Okay, so let's see if we can do this. So we've got now, I believe, 10 to the power, so 18 minus 6, 12. Did I do that right? 8 plus 6, thank you, 24. Okay, so 10 to the minus 24 kilograms per cubic meter. That's also an impressively small number. So the universe is on average far less dense, of course, than the air we're breathing, far, far less dense. Very good. Okay, so now we can compare this. So here's where it gets fun. So cosmologists can measure the total density of the universe using a number of different methods, which you will learn about. So we've learned this from things like the cosmic microwave background radiation, the distribution of galaxies on the largest scales, and things of that nature. And the average density of the observable universe is, and here is where my number will be less impressive and the twiddles will matter, and I should have used better estimates, but anyway. So the observed density is something like 10 to the minus 26 kilograms per cubic meter. And that's something like 5 hydrogen atoms per cubic meter, if we want to put that number in even another context. So again, very, very diffuse. And so we could compare these numbers. They're pretty close. If I did this more carefully, what I should have gotten is something like 10 to the minus 28 kilograms per cubic meter. That's more like the actual average density of stars and luminous normal matter. Okay, so a few orders of magnitude off, but that's fine. This is with Twiddles. And so if I were to compare that more accurate estimate to the observed density, I would see that there's a deficit. Okay, so there is, in fact, a larger density of some kind of stuff than could be accounted for by just the stars. And that, of course, is where we start to introduce the dark universe. So this deficit is basically made up for by saying there's some other stuff and we don't know what it is, but it acts to give us a density that's larger than that just given by stars. So stars make up something like 1% of the average density of stuff in the universe. And dark matter and dark energy make up the rest. So I'm sure you've all seen the cosmic pie chart, which is more or less about 4% atoms, 26% dark matter, and about 70% dark energy. And what I should have done is looked up the error bars on these and the exact values from Planck, because now we know all these things to less than a percent error using cosmological measurements. So you'll just have to trust me that that's super impressive. And yay. Okay, so using our Twiddles, if we had been a little bit more accurate, we would have gotten a little bit of a better answer. But that's where it is. Okay, so any question about length scales, mass scales, densities, things like that? So it is helpful to have these numbers in mind and to be able to make these kind of estimates. So I will leave it at that. And now let's get more fundamental. Okay, so, you know, again, these units are somewhat arbitrary. They're not really based on fundamental things. It just, you know, happens that the distance between stars in our universe is like a parsec. We have a question, sorry. Very good. So it comes from more detailed measurements than this, of course, than my Twiddles. So if we look at the CMB, if you were just to take a snapshot, you'd find that the universe was incredibly uniform. So there are small fluctuations in the intensity of the microwave background radiation, like one part in 100,000. And by studying the statistics of those fluctuations, you can infer the various ingredients that are needed for this pie chart. But to give you a better feel for what that actually means, okay, dark matter. Dark matter surrounds, well, basically galaxies live inside of clumps of dark matter. They're like some small perturbation on that. And so if I have a clump of dark matter and matter falls into it, it enhances how matter clusters. Basically, it makes galaxies easier to form. It makes structures easier to form than if there were no dark matter. If there were just atoms, we wouldn't have as many galaxies. There wouldn't be as big structures as there are that we see today. And so you kind of need this to boost clustering. Okay, so this amount precisely would give you precisely the right amount of boosting so that you know, we get the observed distribution of galaxies and clusters and superclusters. So that's why this is needed. So the dark energy This is basically some substance. We don't know what it is, but as the universe expands, it does not become any more dilute. So that's the basic property of dark energy. The universe grows, but the density of dark energy stays the same. And what that does is, when we talk about Einstein's equations, it causes the universe to expand at an accelerated rate. And that's something we measure, say, by looking at supernovae and measuring how red they are, because light stretches as they move away, versus how luminous they are, which is a measure of distance. So this is more or less here necessary to tell us how the universe expands, okay? How it should expand like we observe it to expand. Because if I just had atoms around, it wouldn't do that. I need the substance that doesn't dilute as the universe expands. So that's roughly speaking why you need these two components. Now, I'll mention one other thing, which is kind of a more basic thing. So this number here, this observed average density, total density of the universe, is really, really close to something called the critical density. And the critical density is basically the critical amount of stuff that you need to get a universe that sort of will never collapse. So if I have a homogeneous and isotropic universe like we have, which we'll talk about in a bit, you've got three options. It can be spatially closed, it can be spatially flat, or it can be spatially open. And something with the critical density is almost exactly flat. So this is another property of our universe related to the sort of overall geometry, the observed geometry of the universe. Okay? So we observe it to be flat. We know there's not enough atoms around to make it flat, because if I just count the atoms, I'm way below the critical density. And so we have to fill in this pie chart with something else. And that's another reason to put something else there.
Solar system, which is, like something maybe like a light day or something, if you want. And even our galaxy is several kiloparsecs. So this is already a factor. And then if you like make this even bigger stretch to the whole cosmos, I mean, it's really like it's a big step, right?
Oh, it's a huge
So when we
step.
say that we have 70% dark energy and 26% dark matter, I mean, which constitutes like almost everything of what is around us. I mean, we usually are. Right, so isn't that also a little bit problematic from this point of view?
It is. No, it's certainly valid to question whether or not I can trust general relativity on these scales, because we haven't really directly experimentally probed it there, but we're getting there. So cosmology is getting precise enough that I can measure things beyond the pie chart. Okay. So now I can measure things like, well, exactly how fast does structure grow? And that's encapsulated in a function called creatively called the growth function. Okay? And general relativity makes a prediction for how things should collapse. And we can measure that. So we can measure and see if not only the overall universe is expanding like it should in general relativity, but also that the galaxies and clusters of galaxies are actually collapsing like we'd expect in general relativity. So if I had an alternative, which, there are people, it's a very hot topic now to talk about modifications of gravity, alternatives to GR, they make different predictions for that clustering. So we can test it. So certainly it pays to have an open mind, and it pays to recognize that we are making a pretty drastic extrapolation from a parsec to a gigaparsec, or tens of gigaparsecs, right? And question it. Yeah, it's a good idea. But that being said, probably in the next 10 years, we would have measured all these quantities to sub-percent precision. And so if there is room for a modification of general relativity, we'll probably know in the next 10 years. Yeah. And then beyond that, it'll get really hard. And the reason it'll get really hard is because there's only a finite number of objects in the universe for us to measure. So we'll kind of reach the limit of our knowledge. in about 10, 20 years, I'd say.
But to these days, Lambda Code Dot Matter is still like the best.
Embarrassingly the best. Like, we're working so hard to make it not the best. And no matter what we do to try and punch holes in this theory, it always seems to work the best. So, go figure. But like I said, there's sort of an upside and a downside to this statement that I made that we'll kind of know the answer in the next 20 years. It could be really interesting. There could be some really interesting deviation that shows up. Maybe it won't be the best one anymore. On the other hand, it might be. And then we're kind of like the particle physicists where, you know, we found the Higgs boson. This is a fantastic achievement, but what's next? So we're kind of at the same precipice, the sort of what's next precipice. Okay, right, I wanted to go on a tangent here. Sorry. Before I get more fundamental, I wanted to go on a tangent. So let's actually talk about this growth of structure. Okay. So this density, it does not stay constant in time. There's a really simple reason for that. If the universe expands, well, at least the stars, they get more dilute, right? So if the universe was static, the density would be the same forever, but it's not. And there's another feature of the universe, which is that it's really inhomogeneous on small scales. Like, we discovered that the density inside a galaxy is a million times bigger than the average density. So it's super inhomogeneous on small scales, but very homogeneous on large scales. So this property, super, super important. If the universe was inhomogeneous all the way up to the largest scales, then doing cosmology would be just about as hard as doing climate science. You'd have some terribly nonlinear, complicated system that would, you know, you'd need some computer simulation that was basically as complicated as the whole universe to solve. So I'm really glad that that's not true, because I'd be out of a job. The fact that the universe is really homogeneous on the largest scales is kind of what allows us to do cosmology, period. Okay. And so, you know, when you go to bed tonight, be thankful. Be thankful for the fact that the universe is homogeneous on large scales, so that you can come back here on Thursday and learn all sorts of interesting things. Because if it wasn't, I wouldn't be able to tell you anything. Okay, so given this, the fact that the universe behaves differently on different scales, it behooves us to come up with a description that separates out scales. And what is a natural description that separates out scales? We should work not in position space, but in harmonic space, in Fourier space, because then there's a natural decomposition of phenomena on different scales. Okay, so if I want to describe the universe, the density field in the universe, of course, that's a function of space and time, generally. I can describe this as a mean density, we'll call it rho bar, times 1 plus a fractional, a fractional density. Okay, and so this thing is totally homogeneous. And so the thing that tells me how the universe is different in different places, the fact that it's not homogeneous, is all encoded in delta. And if I want to ask how delta behaves on different scales, then, as I said, it's convenient to go to Fourier space. So now we're going to get a coefficient that depends on time for each scale, times e to the I k dot x. Let's go there. And, you know, we've measured what, at least statistically speaking, these different Fourier coefficients should do. Again, we do that by looking at the CMB, by looking at the distribution of galaxies and whatnot, but you can just take it for granted that in our universe, this thing looks something like this, if we were to make a plot of how the density fluctuations on different scales, at least today, as a function of scale, how this thing looks like. Let me raise this up so it's a bit easier to see. Okay, so first let's put some important scales. So remember, k is 1 over wavelength. So there's a largest scale that we can see, right? There's like 1 over the size of the observable universe. It's the biggest fluctuation we can see. So if we look at this, and then on the vertical axis here, we're going to put another number, which is 1. So if the fractional difference in density is 1, then you could say there's something there. If I looked at some field and there was a fractional difference in density of 1 in a billion, it would not look like anything. If there was an object which had a fractional difference in density of 1, I could tell it's kind of above, right? It's above sea level. So you can think of delta as a function of space at some time, you know, maybe as looking something like this, and then there would be a blip, okay? So if that blip is order 1-ish, then we say there's something there. It's a galaxy, it's a star, it's an object. So 1 is, this is called the non-linear scale. So we say that the perturbation is non-linear if it's bigger than 1. By non-linear, we mean it's an object, there's something there. By linear, we mean just small ripples, you know, on the sea. It's not a wave, not a big wave. Okay, so what does this look like? So on scales of order the size of our observable universe, this thing is really small. This thing is like 1 in 100,000. Okay, so really tiny fluctuations in density on the larger scales. Okay, so then this grows, but it grows really slow. It grows logarithmically until I get to large enough scales, and then it grows like k squared. Sorry? Small enough scales, sorry. I was somehow, when I look at the pictures, get confused. On small enough scales, large enough k. And there is a nonlinear scale, which happens at roughly 1 over 10 megaparsecs or so. Okay, so that's where we get objects. Below that, we don't really have objects. We just have waves on a more or less uniform sea. So remember what 10 megaparsecs corresponded to. That was like the size of superclusters, like on the lower end. So there are rare things that exceeds this, but statistically speaking, like the average size of an object, like a supercluster, which is the largest bound object, is sort of 10 megaparsecs-ish. Okay, good. And so we can split the universe into two different ranges of scales, right? So there's between the 1 over the size of the observable universe and 1 over 10 megaparsecs. You know, we say that this region, we're in the linear regime, and then over here, we're in the nonlinear regime. And I can describe them separately. And this is more or less consistent. Okay, so I can ask how this part behaves separately from how that part behaves. And how the why? Because the feedback between stuff happening on really small scales and stuff happening on really big scales is relatively small. And that's a consequence of the physics, which I guess is not 100% obvious a priori. Okay, so in particular, we can ask now, you know, sort of here on the largest scales, the universe is the same everywhere, okay? And that's an observable property of our universe. Forget about where it comes from. That's just the way it is. Oh, sorry. I'm gonna break this thing. So on large scales, the universe is more or less homogeneous and isotropic. The homogeneous part you got from up there, the isotropic part is separate. So I can have something that's homogeneous but not isotropic, as it turns out. But as it seems, the universe is probably isotropic. And so we can describe this by one thing, right? So on the largest scales, the one thing I can do is change the overall scale, right? If the universe is really the same everywhere, if it's homogeneous and isotropic, then the one freedom I have is to zoom in or zoom out of the whole picture. And I can just change the overall scale. Okay, and that scale can in general be a function of time and usually is denoted by the lowercase letter a and creatively called the scale factor. Okay, so if I imagine that the universe was really like a grid of different galaxies at regularly spaced points, let's say at each point here there's a galaxy. I won't draw all the squishes, but you get the point. Then we can describe the length of each of these elements, each element of these cells, as some reference length times the scale factor. Now, what reference length? So that's an arbitrary choice, okay? But convention has it that we set the scale factor today equals 1. Okay, so if this was really a regularly spaced grid of galaxies, L would be like a megaparsec. So the convention is that. And so you can see that as time changes, the distance between these galaxies will change. So in an expanding universe, these galaxies will move away from each other. And moreover, if I pick any one galaxy, every other galaxy will be moving away from it. If I pick that one, these would be moving away. If I pick this one, these would be moving away. So every galaxy is moving away from every other galaxy. And that's a consequence of the fact that everything gets scaled. So all distances are scaled. And you shouldn't imagine that sort of space is being created or anything like that. It's really literally just like the distance between these things gets bigger with time. Bottom line. Okay, another thing. So here, if we look in time at this grid and the grid is expanding, then those would be called, this is like the real physical distance. But in cosmology, we like to define another distance which doesn't change in time. And we do that by dividing by the scale factor. OK, Okay, so if I just took this grid and I divided by A, then the distance between everything would always be L. Okay, so that's called co-moving distance. So divide by the scale factor, and distances are constant. And I will probably raise that up so you can see it. Okay, so those distances are constant in a co-moving co-moving frame. Okay, so I said earlier that densities change in time. And now we can really easily understand, at least for stars and galaxies, how densities change in time. Okay, so the density goes like 1 over the volume. Okay, and so the volume is going like, well, if I consider the volume of cubes, 1 over L times the scale factor cubed. Okay, so if there's one galaxy per cubic unit of L over A, then the at least the number density would go like 1 be proportional to 1 over A cubed. And we can set the proportionality constant by our convention. So if the density, if the scale factor is 1 today, then we know that rho has to be the density today, which we'll call rho naught divided by A cubed. So the density of matter, so that's things like stars, galaxies, whatever, is going to go like 1 over A cubed. Okay, so now fact we live in an expanding universe. So rho goes up as we go into the past, right? So as we go into the past, the scale factor gets smaller than 1 because the universe used to be smaller. It's expanding today. And so we get a universe whose density has increased as we go into the past. And eventually, we get to the point where the scale factor is 0. So eventually we get to a point where we if we just continue and we assume the expansion has always happened, then eventually the size of these cells is 0. Scale factor goes to 0. And that's what we call the Big Bang. Okay. So one thing to understand, I guess the only thing I want to talk today, at least about the Big Bang, that you should understand is that as t goes to 0, I can imagine that these cells are just shrinking, right? So my grid is shrinking with time. Density is going up. But this grid goes on forever, right? So I just drew a finite number of cells because I'm lazy. But if I wasn't lazy, I'd fill the whole board. And the only thing that would happen with time is that the size of the individual cells would get smaller. So what does that mean? That means that the Big Bang, you should think of it not... So the Big Bang is just a time, right? It's not a location. There's no preferred location that all these cells go and shrink up into a point. No, it's a time. It's a time when the size of the cells goes to 0. So the Big Bang is a time, not a place, not a location. So that's probably the biggest misconception about the Big Bang, is that it's this point of infinite density. That's not right. It is a time of infinite density. So absorb that. And if you take a cosmology component, never ever say that the Big Bang is a point. You will be in big trouble. Okay. Good. Okay, so that was my tangent about densities and stuff. Any questions about the tangent? Okay, of course, you'll see a lot more about this. And you probably have already seen a lot about this. Okay, so I started before I went on this tangent to talk about more fundamental units. So let's go back to this question of scales. So we chose parsecs because that was a conveniently sized unit. It had to do with astronomical scales. But it's not fundamental, because just like the giant would have described his Earth by the units of arg, which is 10 meters, in cosmology, we could have described our universe by some other units if, I don't know, the stars happened to be closer than a parsec, right? Maybe we would have picked something else. So how can we do better? How can we be more fundamental? So units based on fundamental things. We need to start talking about things that do not change, that do not vary with location, that do not care about who is measuring them or how big they are. And so we should probably start talking about fundamental constants. So the simplest one to start with would be the speed of light. So speed of light is 3 times 10 to the 8 meters per second, we think, everywhere and at every time. So if we pick things that are based on a unit where we use C, then that will be a little bit more fundamental. Okay. So of course, the first thing, the first implication of the speed of light being constant, again, a little aside, is the fact that we're historians. So the finite speed of light means that stuff that's really far away is seen as it was in the past. Okay. I can never really know what's going on today in the Andromeda Galaxy. I can know what was going on some millions of years ago in the Andromeda Galaxy. So the implication of the finite speed of light is that, you know, we're basically historians. And so we can ask, how far back in history do we go? So we can look at the light year. So a light year is a third of a parsec. So now we can ask where we see different things. So, you know, distant stars, we see them as sort of our closest stars, I should say. So there's about a year. So on the closest stars, they are watching reruns of your favorite television program from last season. If we look at the furthest stars in the Milky Way, you know, that's something like 10,000 years. Galaxy, you know, Andromeda Galaxy, they are, you know, about 1 million years ago, and so on and so forth. So, so when you get to the edge of the observable universe, then we're talking really far in the past. So we can ask sort of what, you know, the most distant objects that we can see, which are quasars. Those are an appreciable fraction of the total size of the observable universe. And these things, you know, they are roughly a giga year old. Okay. So we are a historical science. If you care about cosmology, you care about the past, more or less. Okay, another, that was another little tangent, I guess. But where were we going with this? We were going for some more fundamental units. So we are at the Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics, and I give you permission from now forward to always set the speed of light to 1 and never have to remember that it is equal to 3 times 10 to the minus 8, or times 10 to the 8 meters per second. So what does that mean? C equals 1. So we want to use units where we take advantage of that fact. So what is C? C has units of length over time. Excuse me. And so the implication of C equals 1 is that lengths are the same things as time. Okay, so any unit of length, I can choose equivalently to present it as a unit of time. So we can choose. We can either choose length or we can choose time. Your choice. Okay, so that's interesting. We can get even more fundamental. So we've got C. Well, there's some other fundamental constants of nature that we can use at our disposal. So there's h-bar. So h-bar is 1 times 10 to the minus 34 joules times seconds. And I guess I'm like all about twiddles here. So that's not exactly right. And I hope it's not as far off as my estimate of the solar mass was. Okay, we can use the fact that a joule is a kilogram times meters squared over second squared to get that. There's Newton's constant. So I guess I cared about this more because I added some more significant figures. Don't know why. That's meters cubed, kilograms, second squared. Okay. And finally, we've got Boltzmann's constant. And that is 1.4 times 10 to the minus 23 meters squared kilograms over second squared degrees Kelvin. Okay, so let's count them. I got 1, 2, 3, 4 fundamental constants. And I've got 4 things that I care about measuring that also appear as units in these fundamental constants. So we've got length, we've got time, we've got mass, and we've got temperature. Oh, and by the way, if I use special relativity and I note that E is equal to mc squared, we've also got energy. So I've got 4 fundamental constants and plus E equals mc squared. And I've got 5 things that I want to measure. And so in the spirit of C equals 1, where I could choose length equals time, I've got 5 things and 5 fundamental constants. So that means that everything can be unitless. And that's kind of a cool feature of our universe. Okay, so using different combinations of these fundamental constants, I can take any quantity I want and I can make it completely unitless. So I can express everything in terms of pure numbers. It's dimensionless. So the real unit of charge is the defined structure constant, if you will. So that's 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught e squared, which is the charge of the electron, over h bar c, I believe. So we can cast the strength of the electric force in terms of a dimensionless number, alpha, which is 1 over 137. So I claim that charge doesn't matter. Well, we got stuff in here, right? Epsilon naught. Yeah, but that's like, do I want to use SI or CGS, right? I mean, in CGS, the epsilon naught's not there, and then E is just a number. So it's not really fundamental. Moreover, quantization of charge, maybe it's you know, tells me something about what should be in here. But, you know, a priori, I have things that with fractional charge, like quarks. So it's not necessarily a fundamental unit. It could be prejudice, I don't know, but I feel like this is enough. I can cast it as a dimensionless thing involving the other constants. So everything can be dimensionless, and you know, that might or might not be convenient. It kind of depends on how important gravity is. So to make everything dimensionless, I need to use G Newton, and G Newton is sort of very different from the world of quantum mechanics and the world of statistical mechanics. And as we know, gravity doesn't tend to play nice with quantum mechanics. And so there's a convenient intermediate step where I don't make everything dimensionless, but I can write everything in terms of energies. So we'll get super fundamental in a minute. But first we'll talk about particle physicists' units. So particle physicist units, we use two of these constants. Okay, so we'll use h bar and c and set those to 1. And we'll use e equals mc squared. So we saw c equals 1 implies that length has the same units as time. H bar equals 1 implies that energy has the same units as 1 over time, because h bar is a joule times a second. And then E equals mc squared implies that energy has the same units as mass, because C is equal to 1. And those, of course, have the same units as 1 over time. So we can choose. We can choose to measure length, time, energy, and mass in terms of kilograms or EV or seconds or meters, right? We can express all of these things in terms of one unit. And the convenient canonical choice is to express everything in terms of giga electron volts. Okay, why giga electron volts? So now we're kind of back to, a parsec is a convenient unit for measuring astronomical distances and this and that. But here we can choose something that's at least a little bit more fundamental. Let's pick a GeV, and the reason we pick a GeV is because the mass of the proton is roughly 1 GeV. So at least the mass of a proton is something you can imagine an alien on the other side of the universe measuring, and they'd get the same answer as we do. So it's sort of fundamental. Okay, so this is, I would put this under pseudo fundamental. Kind of for the same reason I would put the charge as under pseudo fundamental. This is kind of in the same spirit. Yep. Okay, so this is because it's convenient. And because we also think the mass of the proton is somewhat universal. Okay, so so given that, that we have everything in terms of GeV, we can now just do the write down a set of conversions. And these are useful to memorize, although I'm a hypocrite because I haven't memorized them. So for example, 1 meter is about a half times 10 to the 16 inverse GeV. Okay. 1 second is about 1/7 times 10 to the 25 inverse GeV. And 1 kilogram is roughly 6 times 10 to the 26 GeV. What significance does that number have? Who can tell me? Yes. And what is a number that characterizes how many protons there are, say, in a gram? A mole, right, yeah. So if we turn this into grams, then we'd get Avogadro's number, right? So that pops out. Okay, so to encourage you to use these units, for Thursday, why don't you compute your age, your weight, and your height in terms of GeV? And then if you're embarrassed about, you know, any of these quantities, you can just say, oh, I'm 10 to the 30-some inverse GeV old. Okay, so those are particle physicist units. Those you will see throughout Psi, I'm sure. You should be extremely comfortable with interchanging all of these things. So very comfortable with measuring distances and times and inverse energies and masses and energies and things of that nature. And I can guarantee you that 99.9% of your Psi instructors will be incredibly lazy and you will never see an H-bar and a C or anything like that in any of the equations that are written on the board. So if you want to know what these quantities are in real units, now you know how to do it. Okay, so now we can add one more thing to the mix. So we can add temperature to the mix. And I think this is probably the last thing I'll talk about today, and then we'll pick up on Thursday so we don't get too hungry. Okay, so we have the Boltzmann constant. We're going to set that equal to 1. Okay, and so that implies that temperatures are going to have the same units as energy, or I guess I've also used the E equals mc squared and C equals 1 to say mass and energy are the same thing. And so here now we get a conversion. We get a conversion factor that 1 Kelvin is, again using GeV, 10 to the minus 13 GeV, which, just to get another number to remember, maybe a more human scale number is like 1/10,000th of an electron volt. Okay, so actually adding temperature to the mix is super convenient because it tells us, you know, qualitative information about physics that happens at different energy scales at different times in the evolution of the universe. So let's talk about that. So in the universe, there's a relationship between temperature and scale factor. So as the universe becomes more dense, you might guess that it also becomes hotter. But precisely how much hotter it becomes, we can work out. So you might recall from statistical mechanics that the density, the energy density of a gas of photons is proportional to the temperature to the fourth power. That's Stefan Boltzmann. And we know that for matter, rho goes like 1 over a cubed. But for radiation, I have to add an extra factor of 1 over a. And that's because as the universe expands, not only does radiation become more dilute, but the wavelength also stretches. And that lowers the energy density. So that goes like 1 over a. Okay, so we get 1 over a cubed because the number dilutes, and 1 over a from the redshifting of the energy in every single photon in the universe as the universe expands. And so from this, we learn that the temperature is going to be proportional to 1 divided by the scale factor. Okay, so as the scale factor gets small, the temperature gets big. So the temperature is like inversely proportional to the size of each length of the box of the universe, if you will. Memorize that. That is super important. And if you don't memorize it, it's easy enough to work out. I will make that reappear, sorry. Okay, so now we can ask, when the universe had different sizes, what was the relevant physics? Oh, and by the way, you can fix the proportionality constant because you know that today the scale factor is equal to 1, right? So the proportionality constant should actually be the temperature today. So we can change that to equals T naught. Okay, so now let's ask about different thresholds. Okay. So let's put physics in. So there's a whole lot of hydrogen in the universe, right? So what's an important number for hydrogen? How much energy do I have to put in? Yeah, excellent. So 13.6 electron volts. And 13.6 electron volts, if we use our conversion factor, is something like 10 to the 5 degrees Kelvin. Okay, so if I heat the universe up to a temperature of 100,000 degrees Kelvin, I will not find any neutral hydrogen, for sure. It turns out that the real number is a little bit lower. So the real number is something more like 10 to the 4 Kelvin. When I get to that temperature, it becomes very rare to have a hydrogen atom around that's neutral. Okay, so that means that when the universe was about 10 to the 4 times smaller, it was ionized. Incredibly important fact about our universe. Plasma, so an ionized gas, is completely opaque to light. So when the universe was really hot and young and about 10,000 times smaller than it is right now, it was completely opaque. But then when the temperature dropped below 10 to the 4 degrees Kelvin, roughly speaking, then we could get neutral hydrogen. And all of that heat, in the form of light, of course, was then released. And that corresponded to the formation of the cosmic microwave background radiation. Question? Yeah, so you have to work out the sort of total reaction equation, the Boltzmann equation that tells you about how likely is it that I get a photon that then ionizes hydrogen and versus the probability that the electron and the proton recombine. Yeah. So you fall out of equilibrium, chemical equilibrium, somewhere closer to 10 to the 4 degrees Kelvin than 10 to the 5. Okay, so when the universe became neutral, which happened at a T of around 10 to the 4 degrees Kelvin, or a scale factor of roughly 10 to the minus 4, the CMB was released. And the CMB is, as you'll learn, the most important workhorse tool in cosmology because it basically hasn't interacted with anything since that time. So if we convert this into time, so this is about 380,000 years after the Big Bang when this happened, if we translate that into a time. Okay, so that's one very important piece of physics in cosmology. And we could talk all day about the CMB. So there's two more important numbers that we can get out, or two more important temperature thresholds that come out. And then we'll go eat lunch. So the binding energy of nucleons is something like 1 MeV, sorry, 1 MeV. And so that translates using our units into something like 10 to the 10 degrees Kelvin, excuse me. So again, here, the real number to get sort of unstable nuclei or fusion, basically for high enough T, we're going to get fusion, meaning like the atomic nucleus is not stable, so I'm allowed to rearrange its parts. So at sufficiently high temperature, we get fusion. It's actually a lot lower than 10 to the 10 degrees Kelvin. It's something more like 10 to the 6 degrees Kelvin, and this has to do with quantum mechanics. So actually, it turns out that the probability, again, if we look at these rate equations, gets enhanced. And so I can have fusion at far lower temperatures than the temperature corresponding to the binding energy of hydrogen. Okay, so if we extrapolate back when the universe was roughly like a million times smaller than it is today, you get the formation of elements. And again, having to do with the details which you'll study, you know, from here we get 75% of the universe is hydrogen, and 25, roughly speaking, is helium-4, and all the other elements in the universe get cooked in stars. Okay, and there's other interesting thresholds. So if I have a photon that is a high enough energy, then I can make electron-positron pairs. Right? I have enough energy around to make electron-positron pairs. And that happens at an energy, again, of around 1 MeV, because an electron weighs about half an MeV. And again, that corresponds to about 10 to the 10 degrees Kelvin. So there was, for high enough T, efficient annihilation and creation of electron-positron pairs. So there was no distinction between matter and antimatter. Okay. So when the universe cooled past this threshold, if there was exactly as much matter as antimatter, then everything would just annihilate into photons, and we wouldn't be here. Okay. So somehow, at high enough temperature, there, you know, needs to be a matter antimatter asymmetry. And the origin of this is a mystery. It's one of the biggest mysteries in cosmology. And that by name goes under the name of baryogenesis, the mechanism by which the universe gained a matter antimatter asymmetry. So that when it drops below this threshold, I don't just have everything annihilate into photons. Okay, and then of course we can go to higher and higher scales until we get to scales that are temperatures that are associated with the most fundamental scale, which is quantum gravity. And that happens at a temperature, a really, really high temperature of about 10 to the 32 degrees Kelvin. And next time we'll talk about why. So we'll talk about Planck units and quantum gravity. That's how we'll start on Thursday. Okay, so we'll do that. That'll finish up the discussion of scales, and then I will tell you all about metrics and general relativity, and you'll get to practice your tensors. And so yeah, I'll see you on Thursday. Take care.